It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, the White House flips the trillion-dollar coin on Jack Lew as Secretary of the Treasury. Hey, so listen, would you fly in the new Boeing plane? And why the Consumer Electronics Show somehow lives on. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 11th of January. Glad you could be with us at the end of a week that has been interesting, to say the least. There is going to be a new Treasury Secretary. There is the trillion-dollar coin, various and sundry other topics to wrap up as well, which we will do with Felix Salmon from Reuters, Catherine Rampell from The New York Times. They are in New York in our spacious new studios there. Hey, guys.
It's lovely here.
I know. Isn't it nice? You guys sound different, I have to tell you.
That's because there's more room for the sound to bounce off the walls.
That's right. So I would like a show of hands, and yes, I know this is radio, for those of you who remember the days of early 2009 when we all thought Tim Geithner was about to be fired like tomorrow, right? Don't you feel kind of bad now, you guys?
He said he was going to stick around.
Yeah, but it was the president's pleasure. Yeah, it was the rest of us who were saying he was going to be fired, though, right? I mean, let's spend a minute, actually, on his legacy, shall we? Felix, go ahead.
He took a burning building and he put it out. He is an adept crisis manager, mm-hmm. and he learned crisis management at the IMF and in an earlier stint at Treasury and at the Fed, and those skills were incredibly useful. So at the beginning of 2009, when the economy was just plunging and it was much worse than anyone had thought, mm-hmm. people thought that unemployment would go up a little bit. It went up a lot. There were big solvency questions about the banks, and he was there to put out fires and to do a lot of unusual things and get it right.
Catherine, he did what he got hired to do, basically.
And then he stayed on for another couple of years. And the crisis, you know, the unemployment rate never came down, but the crisis kind of went away, and it's not clear what he actually achieved over the past couple of years.
Well, let's let your compatriot in here. What are we going to get then in Jack Lew, Catherine?
Well, if you look at Jack Lew's skill set and his resume and everything, it's much more budget-focused. You know, he was at mm-hmm. the Office of Management and Budget as the director under two different administrations. His expertise is much more in fiscal issues. He did spend a short stint in finance, he has a lot of critics for that now who seems to be coming out of the woodwork. But he is very much associated with budget issues as opposed to finance. And I think that really reflects the shifting priorities of the administration at this point.
Do you either of you guys think that there will be a huge confirmation fight over him? And here's the root of the question is this, right? We've got the debt ceiling limitations coming up. Will this confirmation hearing be a proxy for that, Felix, do you think?
I think that Jack Lew was chosen in large part precisely because there won't be a big confirmation fight over him. All of the alternatives were much more dangerous in terms of trying to get them through Congress, and he was the easiest candidate
to get through. And he's gotten through Congress twice before. So
oh, yeah,
that
that's
doesn't
true.
Hurt.
Fair point. Fair point. Let me dabble briefly in the trillion-dollar coin, not for its political reality, not for any of its whatever it is, but for the fact that we have now been reduced to this, Felix, or Catherine, actually, I guess we'll go to you, to get a sensible perspective on this, right? We are now reduced to talking about play money.
It's a farce. You know, it's kind of like a Monty Python sketch at some point. You know, it's the Republicans are doing something ridiculous, which is threatening to default on our debt. So liberals are now saying, OK, let's do something equally ridiculous that is rooted in something previously ridiculous that Congress had done, which was grant Treasury the ability to create a platinum coin of any denomination. So, I mean, the whole thing is just sort of an escalation of how silly can you be on either side.
Felix, you want to weigh in there? I heard you chuckling in the background.
I call it the fiscal equivalent of the flying spaghetti monster.
I don't even know what that is.
It's the flying spaghetti monster is this kind of imaginary being which proves that all religion is incredibly stupid. But it's a bit like that. And I don't think that fighting stupid with stupid is usually a great tactic.
All right. We leave it there. Felix Salmon at Reuters, Catherine Rampell from The New York Times. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, there was a little up, a little down, a little up, a little down, and then a little up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You know that phrase, too good to be true? Well, say hello to electronic health records. Back in 2005, RAND said that electronic medical records could save us $81 billion a year. And it does stand to reason, efficiencies, fewer errors, all that kind of thing. And lots of people thought so as well. But maybe you can guess where this is going. RAND has a new report out which says the economic potential of electronic healthcare records hasn't been realized at all, not even close. From the Marketplace Help Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Dan Gorenstein reports.
If you're a doctor, it's pretty easy to understand why electronic health records fall short.
I often describe it as cutting-edge 1995 technology.
Ashish Jha is an internist and health policy professor at Harvard.
A lot of these electronic health records are cumbersome. It's terrible.
Not only that, but often one hospital system can't sync with another's. To many, this is no surprise. Dr. Arthur Kellerman, one of the authors of the RAND study, says programs were designed to reflect the old values of our healthcare system, like billing.
Fast financial processing, accurate documentation of what was done for billing and coding purposes, because that's where dollars flow in American medicine.
Kellerman says here's the real danger. As a doc, it's hard to invest about $50,000 to $100,000 in a health record system that might not be a permanent solution. So lots of providers are sitting on the fence. That, Kellerman says, just perpetuates the inefficiencies that plague the industry.
We have a healthcare system that the Institute of Medicine estimates is wasting $750 billion a year. Our country can afford $750 billion for stuff that doesn't make you feel better or get better.
The antidote? Entrepreneurs. Kellerman says it's just a matter of time before the right person designs something intuitive and easy that turns the health industry on its head. He's hoping that someone comes along pretty soon. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
A tourism campaign in Michigan has found itself wrapped up in some nasty labor politics. Pure Michigan is the slogan that's been headlining some award-winning tourism ads out in Michigan for a couple of years now. But this week, the state attached that phrase to an ad that encourages businesses to come on in because it's got that new right-to-work law, which has, in turn, set off a reaction that is as tart as a Michigan cherry. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports.
The Pure Michigan campaign covers all the bases of tourism marketing, beautiful outdoor imagery, stirring music, even a celebrity voice, Michigander Tim Allen's fatherly tones.
25,000 mornings. Make sure some of them are pure Michigan.
Michigan State University tourism professor Dan McColl has actually seen people tear up.
The Pure Michigan campaign really strikes a chord with people.
It focused on what was great, even while auto plant layoffs made headlines. Many residents have a feeling of pride and ownership about the slogan. That's why some got angry when it appeared in an ad urging business to come to Michigan because of a new law limiting union power.
From a pure marketing perspective, I was shaking my head.
University of Michigan marketing professor Christy Nordhelm says the state needs another phrase.
What the economic and business development folks should be doing is developing their own positioning and their own slogan.
The Michigan Economic Development Corporation oversees marketing for tourism and business. There was a separate business slogan, but it got dumped a while ago in favor of a proven winner.
We wanted to take advantage of a very favorable part of our state, which was the brand Pure Michigan that we had created.
Mike Finney heads the corporation. Nobody complained until the Right to Work ad appeared. Finney told me the reaction has his team rethinking.
We will make decisions on whether it makes sense for us to modify this campaign in any way.
Pure Michigan fans who want their slogan protected from the impurity of politics just might get their wish. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
This has been a weirder week than usual in Las Vegas. Gadgets, gizmos, self-driving cars, and giant TVs. Yes, the extravaganza known as the Consumer Electronics Show wraps up today, having survived reports of its imminent demise. Detractors say the CES is just so much high-tech hot air. But Marketplace's Queenie Kim is here to tell us that the reports of its death, well, yeah, they're greatly exaggerated.
I'm on the 23rd floor of the Las Vegas Hotel, a five-minute walk from the crowded exhibit halls, in a quiet suite rented by Leslie Chard.
Hi, I'm Leslie Chard. I'm the president of WHDI.
Is that a radio station?
WHDI is a wireless HDMI standard.
It lets devices like HD cameras connect to monitors and tablets wirelessly. WHDI is one of hundreds of companies renting rooms in hotels across the Las Vegas Strip in order to hold business meetings. I put the question to Chard. Everybody is proclaiming that CES is dead. How do you come down on that?
CES is alive and hopping. Here, it's not just for consumers to come and look at.
It's about doing business.
Everyone is here. Just this morning, we've had visitors from Israel, from Japan, from Korea, from Germany, all coming into one place.
WHDI works with Samsung, Motorola, and Sony, among others. Chard says meeting with them is critical to creating new products. Myra Chiang is a VP at Ozaki. And she's not really interested in the average Joe or me, the press. Ozaki makes colorful iPad and iPhone cases, and it has a huge exhibit with plush white carpet and a gigantic iPhone sculpture. Why did you come to CES?
Because it's very important to invite all our distributors.
Ozaki distributors are mostly based in Asia. And even though Ozaki is located in Taiwan, Chiang comes to CES to meet with them. As for CES being on life support, with 150,000 attendees and nearly 2 million square feet of exhibit space, the trade show says it had a record year. Back at the hotel, Chard says he wouldn't mind if the show was a little less popular.
CES overloaded Vegas's carrying capacity.
And he says if there are fewer people next year, he's okay with it. I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up, ad campaigns that aim a little higher.
You know, marketers are in the job of trying to harness what's grabbing consumers' attention, and space has always been one of those things.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added another 17 points today, about a tenth of 1%. The finish was 13,488. The NASDAQ tacked on 3 points, a tenth percent, 3125, the closing number there. And it's really hardly worth mentioning the tiny hair that got shaved off the S&P 500. 1472 is where that gauge came to rest. The very same place, by the by, as yesterday. For the week, the Dow and the S&P both picked up about 0.4 percent. The NASDAQ up 0.8 percent since Monday. Fourth quarter profits at Wells Fargo jumped 24% to a record high. So, can you guess what that stock did today? Yeah, capitalism's great. Wells Fargo shares lost almost 1%. Seems investors are nervous that the bank's lending business is being squeezed by lower interest rates. Best Buy reported things could have been worse over the holiday. Sales fell less than expected. The stock rallied 16%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. So how many of you gave the gift of chocolate this holiday season? We'll get an idea when the Rocky Mountain Chocolate franchise releases profits. In Washington, D.C., the House is back in session while the Senate remains on break. That's a good gig. And 20 years ago, a milestone in the network wars, David Letterman announced he was leaving NBC, the Peacock Channel, for CBS. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Shares of Boeing closed off about 2.5% today. Suboptimal is what I think their aeronautical engineers might say about that. But really not so bad given the news of the day. The Federal Aviation Administration came out this morning and said it is going to do a full review, soup to nuts, of the new 787 design, manufacturing, and assembly. Comes after some serious electrical problems and some not-so-serious other kinds of problems. Andy Pastor is a senior writer for The Wall Street Journal. Andy, it's good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
So I read in your newspaper this morning that the FAA spent 200,000 hours certifying this airplane, and yet somehow it seems perhaps not enough?
Well, this is a very interesting development, and I would say it merits the word unprecedented. The FAA hasn't done something like this in at least three decades. They've essentially approved a new jetliner, fully certified for service, carrying passengers. And now, essentially, the FAA said, we want to make doubly sure that, in fact, the airplane is as safe and as reliable as we think it is and we thought it was.
Let's be really clear here. They have not grounded it. They are not saying it's unsafe. They're just going back in, what, double-checking?
Well, that's correct. But in this aviation, this world of aviation, double-checking something like this amounts to a huge black eye and, of course, raises questions among passengers and investors and customers about the reliability and safety of this plane.
Put this in perspective for me historically, though, because it used to be we didn't used to have the chance to discover these things because new planes would just crash and people would die.
That's absolutely right. And the safety record for U.S. commercial airlines in recent years is phenomenal. There are many years where there isn't a single fatality in the U.S. And you have to go back to the 1970s, to the era of the DC-10. Some of your listeners may remember when there were crashes and the FAA and investigators forced a lot of changes to those aircraft. But in recent years, this is quite unusual. The FAA now is essentially saying, we want to make sure not only that the design is as good as we thought it was, but in fact that Boeing is manufacturing them just as we thought they would and that we mandated that they would. And that raises a bunch of questions about their subcontractors, which we can talk about.
Well, let's do that just a little bit because this, I mean, one of the things that happened with this airplane was that the FAA let Boeing self-certify, which does seem a bit of a misnomer.
Well, that is part of the issue, but I would contend that a much more intriguing and important issue is the fact that there are many more subcontractors on this aircraft than there have been on previous planes. This is the nub of the issue. Even minor deviations and defects can create big problems in the air.
So this morning at the FAA's press conference, they actually had a Boeing guy up there on the podium with them. Is that a little bit because the FAA and Boeing are sort of they both find themselves in a little bit of a hot spot here with this all these incidents?
I think you put your finger on the exact point. The Boeing fought vigorously to try to prevent the FAA from making this announcement and from starting this review. When they lost that fight, I think they got as a gift, if you will, or as at least as a compromise, that they would be able to be at the conference and make some statements.
Let's say Boeing calls you this afternoon and says, hey, Andy, we're going to have a special press flight on Monday just to show you everything's good and safe and sound. Are you going to go flying with these guys?
If they have a test pilot flying the aircraft, that's a no-brainer. Of course I would. And if it was a regular commercial flight, I don't work for Boeing. I don't advertise for them. I try not to be completely objective. I think statistically speaking, you have to say that these planes are not inherently and imminently unsafe to fly.
Andy Pastor writes for The Wall Street Journal about Boeing today in the 787. Andy, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
When you take your kids to a restaurant, there is a certain set of rules that apply. Some spoken, sometimes not. Napkin in your lap, use your silverware, not your fingers. Don't talk with your mouth full. And then by the time they're in high school, you hope they've got their manners down. Kids from poor neighborhoods, though, might never have any of those experiences. Which brings me to Cincinnati and the series that our education correspondent Amy Scott has been working on. It's about Euler School and how that school is trying to increase the number of its low-income students who make it to graduation. Today, as Amy reports, success can be more than just academic, you know.
Good morning, everyone, ladies and gentlemen.
Every Wednesday, the seniors at Euler meet for a lesson in life skills. Today's guest is smartly dressed in a suit and artsy glasses. She goes by the name Q.
I'm here to talk a little bit about etiquette, specifically business etiquette. Can anybody tell me what they think etiquette means?
The following week, the students will go out for lunch at a nice restaurant downtown. So today, they go over what to wear. No jeans, low heels, hats off, boys. What to order, nothing too messy or expensive. For some of these seniors, it'll be the first time they've ordered from a menu or confronted a salad fork.
I did not, you know, come out of the womb knowing how to eat at a business lunch. That doesn't happen. And if you make a mistake, stuff happens. So you drop a knife. Do not panic. You're at a restaurant. They have lots of knives.
The class is called Steps for Success. It matches seniors with mentors from the professional world to help them make it to graduation and prepare for life after school. The program's Jim Stilgenbauer says a lot of students at Euler don't get this kind of support at home.
We had one student last year that nobody came to her graduation. The only person that was there was her mentor from the program. So having that adult influence to say, okay, I'm involved, I care about you, I'm paying attention to you, is huge for these kids to stay focused.
The business lunch is meant to help them navigate the kinds of grown-up encounters lots of people take for granted. Co-founder Michelle Phelps says at the lunch last year, one student thought his mentor must know the waitress because they had such a friendly conversation.
For them to be exposed to how you interact with people, you know, what you do in those situations, it's not that they don't want to do right, it's just they haven't necessarily seen it or experienced it.
We still did have a student that just stuck a whole chicken with a fork and ate it off the fork. But, you know, baby steps.
So on a chilly Wednesday just before Christmas, the latest crop of seniors heads downtown. Fountain Square is just a short drive from the rundown row houses and empty lots of Lower Price Hill, but it's a world away. 17-year-old Raven Gribbins, dressed up in new jeans and high-heeled boots, totters past ice skaters and a Salvation Army bell ringer to the Rock Bottom Brewery. The chain restaurant and pub is decked out for the holidays and buzzing with the lunch crowd.
Do you ladies care to serve any appetizers today?
You're just going
to
be doing lunches.
Raven's mentor is Holly Gundrum, a real estate investor and physical therapist. They share a table with another senior, Crystal Cornegay, and her mentor. As they study the menu, Raven considers the chicken quesadilla.
It's like the ones they have at Taco Bell, they have some kind of sauce on it. Yeah. And it's just so good.
But by the time the waiter comes, she's settled on the steak.
How do you like the steak?
Well, not like real burnt, but like well done.
Maybe like a medium.
Holly, her mentor, orders a cup of chili and a salad. While they wait, they talk about sports and college. Both girls have applied to several schools. Raven will be the first in her family to finish high school. Then the food arrives, and the girls face their first etiquette dilemma.
We gotta eat our stuff on fries and pork.
Crystal's mentor shakes her head. They don't have to eat their fries with a fork, so they dig in. The lunch goes well. Nobody drops a knife, and before long, it's time to get back to school. On the drive, Crystal and Raven debrief.
I thought everybody was going to be real, real dressed up, so when I came with pants, I was like, I'm going to be the only person with pants on.
I thought that, too.
As they get farther from downtown, the conversation drifts closer to home.
Raven, did you hear about that boy who died?
Right up there.
By my street?
Yep.
And then it's a lady that's missing, too, right down there. I was like, man.
There was a shooting or something the other day that was right up there by Deals.
Back at school, I get Holly's take on the lunch. She says Raven did pretty well.
Yeah, I guess I would tell her not to order the steak because that was one of the more expensive items on the menu. I'd have just gotten a lunch thing.
Holly knows the finer points of restaurant dining are the least of Raven's worries. The harder part will be getting her to a place where she can use those skills.
I think she's done well looking at all the challenges she's faced, but just graduating from Euler as a senior is not the same as graduating from other high schools in the area, and I think that moving forward into college, she's going to have to work extremely hard. So I worry a little bit about that she could give up.
Raven is determined. She wants to study criminal justice in college and come back and improve the neighborhood.
I want to make something with my life. I don't want to have to depend on anybody or live life like my parents and grandparents had lived. I want to make a better life than what they had.
The kind of life with business lunches. In Cincinnati, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
You can catch up with the rest of Amy's stories from Euler. They're online, marketplace.org. The aerospace company X-Corp hopes to take its first private customers into space next year. Should you be interested in booking passage, it'll cost you almost $100,000. Or you could get Axe body spray to foot the bill. The Macho Deodorant Company has a new marketing campaign out featuring Buzz Aldrin, one of the Apollo astronauts, and a contest. 22 lucky winners will get rocketed to the final frontier because space, it turns out, is a pretty good place to sell stuff. Marketplace's David Weinberg reports.
There have been a lot of milestones in space. There was the V-2 rocket, Sputnik, the manned Apollo missions, but perhaps the greatest achievement, when Pizza Hut delivered the first pie into the cosmos in 2001.
Pizza Hut's pie makers topped their very first space pizza with salami because pepperoni failed the 60-day testing process.
Humans have always been fascinated by the infinite blackness outside our atmosphere, and that has not escaped the attention of marketers.
You know, marketers are in the job of trying to harness what's grabbing consumers' attention, and space has always been one of those things.
Abby Clausen is the editor of Advertising Age. She says the new Axe ad is the type of ad campaign we will see a lot more of in 2013.
The Axe Apollo Space Academy is looking for regular people like you to go into space.
People aren't going to talk about a typical ad necessarily, but they probably will talk about the idea that they could get sent to space by Axe.
When Red Bull sent daredevil Felix Baumgartner into space last fall, he became the first person to break the sound barrier without jet propulsion. And Red Bull set the record for the most live views on YouTube. Over 8 million people watched.
I mean, what an achievement. And people were just glued to their screens as they were watching that.
David Meerman Scott is the author of the forthcoming book, Marketing the Moon. He says the commercialization of space is a good thing because it brings much-needed funding to space exploration programs.
And it ignites the public's excitement for space because, wow, hey, maybe I can go too.
And if you don't have the money, you can always turn to a marketing contest. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note late of a Friday about flu shots, which comes, I should tell you, with the admission that I have not yet gotten mine. The CDC said today the shot this year is, quote, moderately effective against this year's strain of the disease, 62% effective to be precise, which the director of the CDC says should be translated as the shot making you 62% less likely to get sick. The flu is now widespread in 47 states, so it's coming to wherever you are, and I am going to the drugstore this weekend. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 17 points, about a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ up 3 points, a tenth percent. The S&P 500 shaved off a tiny fraction of a point, closed basically flat. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Star Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. JJ Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal financial Marketplace Money, crowdfunding as business model.
We see many cases in which projects have actually gone through a crowdfunding campaign, done very well, demonstrated success to a publicly traded company, and then the publicly traded company picks up the product and sells it in their stores.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We are back here on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.